Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, broadcasting and video streaming from our studios in New York City. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour, and I welcome you. Most of us have heard the term mindfulness. It occurs when we are open to all the potential we inherently possess. When the self is open to its full potential, the world is presented before us with great clarity. Each and every one of us have experienced flashes of mindfulness, truly remarkable moments in our lives. Most of us believe we can only hope to bump into these moments as if they're out there waiting for us. Today I'll offer you the fundamentals for increasing such moments so that each day can be a remarkable set of experiences. We've been led to believe that, well, maybe we can have a remarkable experience in our quest for happiness. And the happier we are, the more these experiences we'll have. Our problem is simple. We focus our energy upon the tools of happiness, but not on happiness itself. We put so much energy into having the right relationship, working on our bodies, getting ourselves into shape, working on our diet, succeeding in our career, trying to receive some sense of acknowledgement from the people in our lives, family or friends or co-workers, that we're doing the right thing. Now stop for a moment and think, how many times in your life have you been undivided in your attention to achieving something and you succeeded? Did you feel happy? Did it bring you that sense of fullness? Or did you reach that goal and realize, gee whiz, it's not enough. There's something I'm missing. And you start the journey over again, a different partner, a different location, a different career. What was missing? Not enough money? I wished you could sit across from me when I'm counseling some of the wealthiest people on the planet. I was fortunate to be invited by 22 of the finance managers, the money managers for some of the wealthiest people alive. And these people were miserable to a person. Yet they had billions, tens of billions of dollars under their control. They themselves were extremely fulfilled financially, unfulfilled in their lives. And one of the gentlemen went for a walk in the morning that I was invited in to give some insights to them on health issues. And as we were doing a power walk down the beach, he stopped and he said, "I'm aware that I handle some of the fortunes of the most successful people in Japan, and I myself have built quite a lifestyle for myself, but every day I'm hiding from my authentic self. And another deal, another client, another $1 billion of management on my side of the chart will not make me any happier or more fulfilled." He said, "Could you address this at our meeting this afternoon?" I said, "Sure." And that's what I addressed. And suddenly I got everyone's attention because they were all suffering from this. But from the outside, this is never shown. When we see profiles of people who've been successful, we generally see what? We see them on their yacht and on their private jet. We see their jewelry, walking the red carpet if they're a celebrity, invited to save the world if they're Bono, or at a Davos forum. People strive to get invited into that rarefied air of accomplishment where they're universally known as being successful. But I'm sitting across some people all the time who are very successful and are lonely. They're empty. They're terrified to be around anyone who will challenge them on anything that they're not successful about. So they stay with certain type of people in certain environments so that they're never found out. We never know them as being anything less than almost perfect in our minds. But that's the reality of the world we live in. So it is any wonder, then, that we have so many bad decisions by politicians, heads of corporations, people that are supposed to be overseeing the protection of the environment or our finances or our healthcare systems, have you seen a bigger mess than our medical industrial complex? Well, yeah. We have spent $3 trillion a year on disease, and we haven't conquered any of the major diseases, with the exception of prevention, and that's not from the paradigm. That's from those outside the paradigm who are looking at, why don't we prevent something rather than try to treat it? But the paradigm hasn't learned. It's just as inefficient and corrupt as it's always been. But you would never know that speaking with any of the people seeking grants or treating patients. You'd think, well, they got their act together. Do they? Or do they give the illusion they do? How often do we reward people in their field for their efforts, but we never then look at the results? If we look at the results of all the different institutions, our banking institutions, our educational institutions, our healthcare institutions, our social institutions, we would say you're not doing the job you're supposed to do. We're not getting the results. We have half of all Americans are at the poverty line. 50 million Americans are in dire poverty. 18 million children go to bed hungry. We have a planet that is imploding with global warming and the consequences of it, and we're doing nothing to stop it. We talk about it. We have meetings on it. You have committees on it. But when it finally comes to saying, we must close down these industries, we must have those industries that are polluting be responsible for stopping their pollution, we won't do it because the system is gamed. All systems, all paradigms are gamed. We're told that we should get married and have children and buy a home and live the American dream. And we do that. But it doesn't become a dream for most people, especially when they're now underwater in their mortgages, when there's a very high rate of suicide and divorce, child abuse. 6 million children will be physically abused this year in the United States. When did you see a special on television about that? You haven't, and you won't. We ask people to buy what they don't need, to pay for money that they don't have, and then when they get the bill, somehow they're not supposed to see that they're paying 18 to 100% interest, depending upon if they make the payment on time or if they're late. We're not supposed to focus on the person who is so poor and so desperate they have to take out a payday loan and pay 400% interest. We're not supposed to focus on the fact that we take our best farmland that's been there for generations, and we don't look at the fact that we've run out of water because we've misused the natural resources. We've drained the aquifers. You could have a farm that produces produce, and yet if that water was going to the farmer, they'd still be producing. But instead, it may be going to gas hydrofracking, millions of gallons, far more than what 100 farms would use. But the politics and economics say, we don't care about the farmer. We don't care about the towns. We don't care about it, your water being polluted. But we do care about those people that pay the legislators to get the laws passed to say they can use in unlimited ways the water. And then one day, people are so frustrated. They see the corruption. They see the false promises. They see the psychopath and sociopathic tendencies of so many people in power and celebrities. And they think, is this it? Is this life? Is this what we're supposed to do? Routines, boring routines, be bored out of our minds. We live such small, such narrowly defined lives. Everyone tells us what to live by, the rules of engagement. And now we have to distract ourselves. So whole industries are formed to make sure that we're never bored. We pay for it. Violence. Violence seems to stimulate us. Zombie films stimulate us. Cataclysmic events stimulate us. Plane crashes stimulate us. War stimulate us. What about happy and positive things? Things we have control over. Things that can bring us to a different state of consciousness. That we don't talk about. That's kind of voodooish, new age-ish, touchy-feelish. We don't trust it. It hasn't been scientifically quantified. And so, the very idea that we could get off the existing grid to separate out the fact from fiction in our belief systems, to stop the ritualization of our life as if this is Groundhog Day. Every day is going to be the same. And so we retreat into medications. People are bright enough to know they shouldn't be using the psychoactive drugs or the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, Prozac, Paxil, Zoloft. They know that their problems will not be solved. Nobody's problem is solved by these drugs, unless you think that solving a problem is suicide. And that's not a way to solve any problem. And yet the incidence of suicide is skyrocketing. It's not fun getting old in the United States. It's also not fun being a young person with the pressure of knowing that you're going to go into a college program where there's a high probability there will not be a living wage job when you get out. And you'll have to live with your parents, and you'll be in a debt peonage with privatized prisons, debtors' prisons, if you don't pay. And you think, what's the point? And we have a lot of young people committing suicide. Yet why isn't that discussed? It isn't. We will not discuss that which directly and essentially impacts us. Instead, we talk around issues. We talk about issues like Obamacare and signing up for it, or a missing plane, as if that's the most important issue in the world. But what about our lives today? What if you're a woman, 47 years old, with such potential, wonderful personality, intelligent, creative, but you spend your day on meds, in clutter, self-mutilating, and yet you're smarter than all the choices you make? Why don't we address that person's issues? Oh, because we have millions of women of different ages engaged in self-destructive habits. So instead of asking why are they doing this and what can we do to change the circumstances and prevent this, we put our energy on the newest pill. This will take care of those blue feelings. No, it won't. Unless you want to create an emotional zombie, it doesn't change anything. Just like drinking doesn't either. Nor eating your comfort food until you're obese. Until the heart attack or the stroke or the colorectal cancer is the final strategy that you're given. Do I change or do I die? Shouldn't be that way. And that's why I'm concerned. That's why I believe that we should pay attention to mindfulness. At a ranch that I owned at one time down north of Dallas, where the crisp atmosphere was undisturbed by city lights or pollution, the sky often held magnificent cloud formations and exquisite sunsets, giving the sensation of immensity and expansion. When you're alone with that vast sky overhead, free of stress and worry, free from conversations and distractions, there's a feeling of oneness with your environment around you. Just you connecting with the consciousness of the moment that you're in. That's an example of a remarkable moment of mindfulness. Just attempting to describe the sky's immensity, cloud patterns, and far-reaching sunsets to someone else cannot possibly convey your experience. So it is with all of our moments of consciousness. We have to show up for the experiences of our lives. We have to be walking in the direction of our fear, insecurity, our pain. We must have the courage to embrace these limitations, these negatives, these dark side issues. We must not look to distract ourselves, to disguise it. We cannot afford any longer to hire people to put a picture of us on a mirror that is idealistic to what we want to see and completely distant from the reality that's looking back We need to look at ourselves for who we are and accept ourselves for who we are in this moment. As bad as we may be, as limited, we must accept that because that's where we begin our journey. When we do have a remarkable moment, it might happen when we're with someone we are overwhelmed with, enamored by. There is an exchange that takes place when we share energy with a person that we care about, that we love. Although the exchange is invisible, we know it's real because that energy makes us vibrate. We feel it move throughout our body. There may even be moments when that experience returns to us when we're alone and thinking of our loved one. These are remarkable moments connecting us to authentic reality. That's real. A fundamental law of the universe is that never forgets our experiences. The level at which every cell and molecule in our body vibrates depends upon both the nature and the moment that we're in and the memory of every other moment we have ever experienced. Every cell and every molecule in our body is waiting for a sign from our environment, for some word, some gesture, some sound, aroma, something to trigger a moment that brings us to a deep realization of the significance of our lives. If a present experience triggers a positive experience from our past, then the energy we receive back is pleasurable. For example, about 10 years ago to 15 years ago, PBS was bringing back the old doo-wop musicians. Why would doo-wop music be popular in the 21st century? But it was. It was a blockbuster. The programs were popular for those viewers who could remember a special moment in their past when doo-wop music brought them pleasurable experiences. There was a time when doo-wop meant something to them. It might have been a moment of romantic tenderness with a girlfriend or boyfriend while listening to the music on a car radio. Or it might be reliving a moment of youthful freedom on a dance floor, feeling like a person that was full of unlimited possibilities. As memories return, the mind relives past events and the feelings associated with those memories. Where were those memories residing all that time? At the conscious level, they are not always present. But in fact, they're always present. Every single moment of our lives, everything we've ever done is stored. Nothing is ever forgotten. Nothing is ever lost. What really matters is the way in which we connect with those memories. We want to connect with the joyful memories, but we also connect with memories we prefer to forget because they were upsetting or traumatic. Experiences that caused us fear and insecurity and anger, jealousy and rage, or a sense of being violated or unappreciated are also present. Not only are unpleasant memories stored in our cells, they also unconsciously shape much of our daily behavior. So we need to learn how to create these moments that emphasize and build upon our positive experiences. The cumulative effect of remarkable moments opens us into a new state of consciousness. Take a moment to reflect on people you know who have lived an illuminative life. What distinguishes them from you? They are not inherently different from the rest of us, but they appear to be living at a different level of consciousness. They exude qualities of lightness, ease, and being at peace with themselves. They seem to flow through life, and they project an acute awareness the moment they are in. We are drawn to them because we feel their energy radiating just from their presence. Even in those that we stand in front of their artwork or read their writings, we are inspired. I've been blessed by knowing many remarkable people in my life. Starting at a very early age upon my arrival in New York City, knowing no one, being very naive, but I was fortunate to meet, in the period of under 5 years, Dr. Emmanuel Ribisi and Linus Pauling, and Paul Swan, the great Renaissance artist, and Abram Hoffer, the founder of orthomolecular psychiatry with Linus Pauling, Sarah Dona, a grand dame of radical literature who was a radical feminist back in the 20s and teens. They were all at the end cycle of their life, and I was just at the beginning. So I was watching them, and like watching a great Fred Astaire film, I saw that what caused most people to pause and to go into self-doubt and to come from insecurity, should I not, maybe, maybe not. I know what I have, and I'm afraid if I challenge it, I'll surrender it, and then I won't have anything. I'd rather live with the limitations of what I know than the uncertainties of what I don't. And so, time and again, I befriended younger people who had skills, insights, gifts. None of them, not one, ever went forward in their life. Their conditioning and their fear and insecurity limited them. And yet these other people, none were wealthy, but they didn't work for financial security. They loved the challenges of life, and they embraced the challenges every single day. And to be around that could only be inspiring. Could you imagine making your decisions from yes, I can, instead of I don't know, I'm feeling insecure? And that immediately turns the switch in our DNA into the off position. Watch what happens to your health when you turn the switches on by saying, yes, I can. And that makes the difference. So when you watch Fred Astaire dance, yes, he spent a lot of time practicing, but he also had the it. And we've all met people in life who have the it. They have it. We can't describe it. It's not in any dictionary, but we all know what it is. When you watch Cary Grant act, he had it, as did John Wayne, or Spencer Tracy, or Katharine Hepburn. They had it. And the philosophers that had it. And the artists who would not be stopped by society's norms, like Picasso, they had it. And the great scientists had it. I'm sure that we have all met people who had it but weren't aware of it, except that they seemed just to flow effortlessly in whatever they did. They were not like Sisyphus that rolled the boulder up the hill and then prided themselves on the fact that they would never get to the top. There was always self-doubt. It would roll back, but the process of life was always every day with the uncertainty if you would get to the top. Go as far as you could, knowing it would come back down. How many times in life have we made a gesture, a token effort to succeed at something that was meaningful to us, that would liberate us? But it required the liberated mind to engage in the liberated experience. Try doing something with a conditioned mind, and you'll have no liberation from it. You'll just have multiple experiences, none of which will impart the wisdom that we need that allows us to transcend our conditioned self. Talk therapy won't do it. Reading the self-help books won't do it. Watching Oprah has never done it. And yet we like to believe that somehow we are a passive spectator that merely require the right type of rescue. So then we put ourselves into the story mode. If I write the story of my life, the story of my woe, if I can show I'm a victim, if I can show that I suffer, I bleed, I cry, then there will be those who will feel sorry, and out of empathy and compassion will come and rescue me, and that will give me the happiness and the security I need. No, it won't. And it never has. But if you're really good at your story, if you've mastered how to be a victim, you will always have people trying to rescue you, and you will give some faint effort at it. But you know the game. The game is mastery, the art of victimization, and you have a project for life. But if you don't see yourself as a victim, but rather you see yourself as responsible for the choices you make at this moment, then you can learn the lesson of what it means to empower yourself. And therefore, if you're benefited by anyone's input, you take that and go forward, because you're going forward with a fresh, clear, clean slate, conscious and mindful mind. And therefore, you will succeed. But just have people motivate you, and the moment they're not there, you deflate like a flaccid balloon. And we just don't seem to understand this. So, I frequently assist in animal rescues. I've allowed my homes upstate New York for 13 years in Texas at the ranch and in Florida to be used as, in effect, an animal sanctuary. People just drop animals off, sometimes with no notes, nothing. And it's especially challenging when you have baby primates, because a primate, like a human, has many of the same emotions. And if they've been abused or neglected, you can see it. Their fear, they'll hide. They'll cover themselves in a blanket and won't come out. They'll be angry and lash out. So it takes a great deal of patience that you have to understand. You have to rebuild the love connection with this wonderful little creature that has not had it. And then one day, out of patience, it arrives. When one of them crawls into your lap and looks at you or gives you a kiss and expresses contentment in its own unique way. I remember getting a little capuchin that was very small and was very fearful. And for 3 days, this little creature wouldn't show itself. It was in its little traveling case that it came in. And I would work at my outdoor porch, and I had it sitting there, though I didn't look inside and couldn't see it. It was the back of this little traveling case, but it had water and food. And on the third day, I see this little tiny finger stretch out and just touch me on the finger and then pull back. So I leave my hand there. About 10 minutes later, it sticks its little finger out and touches me again and pulls back. And then the next time it did it, I turned my hand over so my palm was up. So as it touched my finger, I just moved my finger a little bit. And within about 6 hours, it actually was leaving its hand on my hand. And then I heard this little hoot, and that's what they sound like. They'll go, hoot. And I looked up, and here's this adorable little tiny face with these big eyes looking up at me. It had taken a step towards reconnecting with trust. And then within a week, it was able to have a teddy bear and a security little blanket, and it would be in a crib, a baby crib, at the bottom of my bed. And then one night, it was maybe, I'm going to guess 3 weeks later, about 1 o'clock in the morning, I could hear this movement, and up comes a little capuchin, little baby, with its teddy bear and its security blanket, but it comes up and it lays down on my chest, and it purrs. And when a baby capuchin purrs, that's their ideal contentment. They're bonding, as if you're their mother. So I made a little pocket and kept it on my chest. And so the little capuchin that could fit in the palm of your hand would always be at the heart energy level, so it could hear the heart and feel the heart and get little kisses. And today that is the happiest, most joyful capuchin. I have found homes for all kinds of animals. I'm guesstimating about in the thousands of dogs and cats and or animals that are given to conservancies or to 4-H groups. But there's something joyful, there's something that is wonderful when you see people who are now feeling instinctively that they know that the environment they're in will provide comfort and joy. And the same is true for human infants who have no fear of being dropped by the mother and when you're playing and you're swinging them and gently, and they laugh, they giggle. But if you were to drop them several times or yell frequently, they'd be afraid, and then they start constricting. If a toddler does something you disapprove of and you scold and smack them or your child, the child will cower or hide. Eventually, the child will fear you and other adult authorities, and those early traumatic experiences become embedded in the child's cells as memories, and it will take a considerable effort to overcome the fears that were conditioned by those destructive experiences. Adults who have been abused and neglected or denied in their past may hold the energy of those memories tightly, which can constrict their muscles and affect their immune systems. It can constrict you mentally. Your beliefs and your judgments about the world can constrict. And if these people lack sufficient remarkable moments in their lives, they may not see the world as a wonderful, positive place with enormous potential for experiencing creative and pleasurable energies, but rather as something threatening and wrathful, something to be demeaned instead of desired. I'm sure you've been in the presence of people who seem numb to life, the whiners, the blamers, the moaners, the complainers. They don't feel anything because they cling to all of their discomfort towards the world. In contrast, we also know people who seem like endless running rivers of love, who are unafraid of opening themselves to life's bounties and becoming vulnerable in order to accept what the universe has to offer. I have found it very interesting to observe that it is only when people make themselves vulnerable that they are able to grow. There is no growth and no authentic feeling towards life when vulnerability is missing. Hence, we are only making calculated decisions. Why? Because insecurity and fear of failing guard us. But it's a big, big price we pay. If we live solely with our past pains, allowing tormenting wounds to register in us physically and emotionally, then no matter what we attempt to do, we will not proceed with an openness that enhances growth and illumination. Vulnerability is a crucial initial step towards being open, conscious, and mindful. So if we wish to become mindful, being present in the moment, open, dynamic, loving, and caring, we need to be conscious of our thoughts. In order to prepare ourselves for this step, we also have to learn to stop constantly trying to escape the emptiness we feel nagging in our lives. The emptiness is not real, of course, but we don't even allow ourselves the chance to slow down enough to discover its illusory nature and the truth of our vibrant connection to the world. One of the most common ways to avoid facing an empty sensation is to occupy ourselves with something or immerse ourselves in our habitual routines, even our mind games and our stories. Everything we do to remain busy, including all of our addictive behavior, our dysfunctional behavior, is based upon anxiety and fear of that emptiness, which we would rather avoid or fill than confront. How we busy ourselves depends upon our earlier conditioning, our intellect, our status in the community, and our unique disposition. For example, some people are afraid of exposing their true emotions to others, so they present facades that cover up their intentions. They might try to fill their emptiness with beauty, surrounding themselves with beautiful possessions or obsessing about their appearance. But there is a fundamental flaw to such strategies. Imagine for a moment you're a beautiful person by accepted social standards. But then a day arrives when you realize that your beauty is impermanent. A beauty that only conforms to society's norms is going to end eventually, right? All models get older and are no longer marketable as a commodity of beauty. How are you going to feel when you're no longer accepted for being a beautiful person or a sexy person or a stud? Or masculine. as long as you're desired, beauty is your opium. It puts you into an altered state. Yet deep inside you, there's another voice saying, but only for today. What happens if you have no other value but your beauty or body to bank on, and then the currency of your glamour runs out? Suddenly you'll find yourself starting to maneuver and manipulate in order to connect with someone who is successful and won't care about your beauty's demise. You will then have security to replace the emptiness that you filled earlier with your attachment to being beautiful. This is a scenario that I've seen people enact many times. I've also observed how so many men and women today avoid associating with those who are authentically aligned with illuminative qualities, who could offer them a vital connection to something essential. Instead, they seek people who will provide or support their needs for security. Security can mean something different for each person. One of the most common manifestations of security is our desire to put down roots with a family and children and own a home. Such pursuits are perfectly fine unless you're tied to a person you don't really love. A relationship that is nothing more than an accommodation of our insecurities is a dangerous path to embark upon. Unfortunately, this is all too common as a problem, and children in particular suffer from our mistakes. We thought we would make a great parent, and then we see 14 million orphaned children and 6 million a year abused. Clearly, those people were delusional about how they would make a great parent. In point of fact, it is my experience that only when a person is balanced, harmonious, constructive, coming from a spiritual place, do they really make a good parent. Everyone else fails by degrees. One of the biggest mistakes that we have seen people make is putting into our minds that there's a biological clock and that your value as a person is to the manifestation of your biological imperative to have children. Okay, then why not adopt a child or be a big brother or big sister? Think of the love that those children need and could benefit from. But we say, no, it has to be my child. Why? That's always a red flag for me. Why? If you really care about children, shouldn't you care about all children? Then you ask them about what have you done for the starving children in America, the homeless children in America. There's 1.6 million homeless who leave school each day and have no home to go home to. And there's 18 million who don't have a good meal. Well, they haven't done anything. I see. And what have you done in the way of committing yourself on a regular weekly basis to social issues that can make it a better world for children everywhere? Well, they've heard about that on radio shows and read some articles, but not yet. I see. Well, what have you done to help the environment? Nothing yet, but you're conscious of it. I see. So you're like the person who listens to my noon radio show for the last 39 years, and because I'm dealing with so many health issues, you think that's a good way of connecting, but you still smoke or drink or eat meat or not in shape. It's a game people play. Do you really think those people would make great parents? And then we're telling people, you're lonely, you've had some bad relationships, but this time, have a kid. That's it. Oh, let me think this through then. If I don't have a life that's fulfilling, I should have a kid and that'll make my life fulfilling. No, it won't. And yet you may put everything you have into having that kid and giving everything to him. What do you think the emotional status of that kid's going to be when all of your insecurities and fear, your judgments, are going to come right through epigenetically into that developing fetus, into the developing child? You're going to protect them from the real world that you've been hurt by. Mm-hmm. And how exactly is overprotecting a child in their formative years? How's that going to help them, help their character, their awareness of the world? I know of several people personally who could not get their life together. So they had a kid that meant for the next 18 to 20 years, they didn't have to focus on themselves because they could be preoccupied with this child. Overloving, overgiving. Well, love can't be overgiven, but you can smother a person, micromanage their lives to make sure they don't make any mistakes. I've seen the consequences of this also. It doesn't come out good in the end. But what we're terrified of is just asking ourselves, are we really qualified to have children? Are we qualified for quality relationship? If you haven't had a quality relationship with yourself, how in the world are you supposed to have it with another person? Just adapting to people is not the reason to be in a relationship. Adaptation is too common. Harmonizing at the highest level of our being and share the best that we are, that's a different story. So we take a look, and we look honestly, and we see how insecure most people are and what they do coming from that insecurity. How is it possible that our society can have such a high failure rate in satisfying relationships? About 95% of all relationships either end in failure or the people are not fulfilled, but figure, well, I'd rather, you know, live with a relationship that I have because I know its limitations, know it's not fulfilling, but it's better than being alone. Wow. What does that tell us? One fundamental reason is that so many people get into serious relationships before they have developed an authentic relationship with themselves. How can we contain so much insecurity, uncertainty, dysfunction, fear, and sense of incompletion and expect something healthy and authentic to come forth? Living an inauthentic life, conditioned by the negative moments from our past, makes us hide our foibles. We're afraid to be identified with our weaknesses and failures, so we compensate by wearing masks and putting on airs. We give the appearance of being secure, happy, responsible, conscientious, and industrious. But then where is the real person? When our masks are removed, we're simply human beings existing on the edge of a void, busying ourselves, running around the edges of a darkness so we don't have to realize we are already in it. With our social commitments and careers, life turns into a huge effort of multitasking. If we have kids, too, there is even less time left to examine anything meaningful about ourselves. That would be considered selfish. You pass your significant other in the house and forget when you had quality time that you spent with each other. We are trying to do so many things that we can hardly do any of them well. If we don't give quality time to anything we do, everything will eventually suffer. It's like making an electrical repair in the home. You can either do it properly or you can mend it temporarily. In American society, we are masters of temporary repairs, temporary health care, temporary commissions that discuss problems without providing sustainable resolutions, and temporary measures. Well, look at all that. Little is done authentically, and therefore few problems are actually solved. So what kind of life are we living if it is not a sustainable life? Whenever I'm confronted by a choice, I have to decide whether it can be sustained in a complete and balanced way. If it can't, then I should not do it. Moreover, everything in life, every choice, is an exchange. If I'm going to exchange imbalance for balance, then I must surrender everything that generates imbalance. Wasting time creates imbalance. Giving our energy to pursuits that are trivial and underserving of our efforts creates instability. Absorbing the energy of other negative people who are bitter and angry, judgmental and hostile, who are inconsiderate and respect no boundaries, absolutely imbalancing. Living in a toxic environment, imbalances. when we are imbalanced, unhealthy, and caught in a web of inauthentic relationships, everything we undertake is going to be based upon a fear of losing whatever it is we feel a need to control. When we exert a lot of energy by trying to control something we feel we're losing a handle on our imbalance manifest. For example, people try to control others with jealousy. Jealousy is a straitjacket we wrap around something, someone, but it immobilizes us simultaneously. How comfortable are we with ourselves and with another person when we're in a straitjacket together? Envy is another form of control. We see a person with something we don't have and we feel incomplete without it, so we try to get it for ourselves. When we finally acquire the object of our envy, we realize we are not any better with it. All we really received for our efforts are bills, an emotional bill, a time-wasting bill, a misuse of energy bill, and a distancing from the spiritual side of our nature bill. Take a glance at all the things you own and once felt you needed but really, really had to have, right? There's a concrete example of decisions that originated from a place of imbalance. Fear, insecurity, the lack of an authentic sense of self, the feeling of an incomplete life, and giving up positive for negative energy all create our imbalances. A common phrase we hear from people's lips is, "I wished it were Friday." Why? That's actually a terrible thought because it means today doesn't count. It suggests there's a little real life and little real sacredness in today. Moreover, underlying this thought is the false assurance that if you get through today, then tomorrow will be better. This is simply a negative exchange of energy, an exchange of the reality of this moment for the illusion that tomorrow is going to be a better moment. And how often does tomorrow turn out to be any better? Instead, we should be asking about what we need in order to create balance. Once there is balance, there is less disease and disharmony. After all, if you have balance in your diet, you're going to select the foods that actually provide good nutrition, that prevent disease, the fruits, the vegetables, the nuts, the grains, the seeds, the herbs, the juicing. And then balance, eat what your body needs. Don't gluttonize. Then eat it in a form that honors it. Eat it living, raw, whole, instead of deep-fried, barbecued, and grilled. One creates balance and harmony of health. The other creates imbalance and disease. Now, we're going to do one or the other. And eating an imbalanced diet and taking a vitamin will not compensate. Doing foolish, negative things to your partner and then saying you're sorry doesn't cut it, especially if it's a pattern of behavior. So what do? We then get used to people living in balanced lives with us and hope that it gets better. It never does. We simply adapt to more. And as a result, there we are today. How often do you find yourself obsessing over something that didn't go the way you had expected? Afterwards, you find yourself rerunning a parade of thoughts. Well, I wished I'd have said this, I should have done that. You repeat those mantras over and over in your mind. How does thinking obsessively about something that happened in the past change anything? It does not. You just surrendered precious time to obsess over it. You exchange an opportunity to let go from an opportunity to engage your mind in reliving compulsive thoughts. You need to surrender what you cannot control, and you should not control, and simply be present to accept the moment you're in. From there, you can see clearly the choices that will guide you. So be conscious and be present. Surrender everything that imbalances you and replace with something that creates an authentic, sustainable life. Love and joy and hopefulness and vulnerability and creativity and passion and pleasure and a pure belief in yourself are qualitative energies of an authentic life. When you connect to those energies, you support your growth. Surrendering all of your past conditioned needs that no longer fit into your life and your new story. The story where you're taking a real journey of completeness and not the incomplete dark journey of the stories from past. When you do that, you're ready for remarkable moments because you're open and vulnerable to experience them, and you'll find joy in them, and you won't have to wait for them. They'll be everywhere. They always were. You just weren't seeing them. The reason why every day is not a remarkable moment is because we are carrying yesterday into today in order to justify the way we feel. We repeat old behavioral patterns over and over as if our behaviors will miraculously produce different results. We should stop fighting yesterday's battles. Fear is perhaps the single most important motivating factor locking down our mind into an inauthentic, artificial life, which curtails much of our potential for growth. We construct our existence out of the building blocks of our fears. Certainly, we are all going through the motions of making efforts, believing we are changing because we have different experiences, relationships, jobs, residences, a variety of interests and activities. However, experiences aren't truly relevant unless we treat them as lessons and grow during the process of facing them. And the lesson of fear is one of the most important lessons to confront. One way to deal with our fears is by consciously experimenting with your life and beliefs. If we are afraid of connecting with illusion, then we will continue to live by illusion. We need to connect with that which is real and express ourselves honestly. Some conversations can't be authentic because the conversation aims to be accepted and to avoid criticism and rejection. So for one full day, commit yourself to being completely honest about everything you say and think. Detach yourself from all your fears about imagined consequences and just be honest and allow events to unfold. There's no need to be mean or cruel or harsh in your words and tone. Simply by being compassionate and honest and uncompromising in that respect, see what happens. Speak gently and truthfully to everyone you talk to and observe the responses you receive. When we're absolutely honest with ourselves, we are raising the standard by which we feel, act, and communicate with others. Living an honest life enables new and remarkable events to unfold for us. We discover that the rewards gained by being honest are far greater than those when we were entangled in our inauthentic, selfish, conditioned, and manipulative selves. During conversations, listen attentively without the conditioned ego's prejudgment. Only then will you be able to respond honestly because your authentic self will be processing the information. Instead of personalizing your conversations, go into neutral. Whenever you personalize, you become upset with whatever disagrees with your feelings and your needs. The subconscious mind activates when you are upset and launches a volley of conditioned responses, which may result in your reacting from your ego. The ego will try to subordinate the real self because it is the master of all your defense mechanisms. Why do you think so few people won't attempt to undertake anything out of the cultural norm? It's because their defense mechanisms defend and justify their fears. The ego circumvents authentic risk-taking that would lead to growth and elimination. It is important to understand that if people denigrate your inspiration, they are not really listening. They are reacting, not toward you, but towards themselves. Their egos, not their authentic selves, are conditioned to react. The ego serves as a frontline attack dog for every belief system reacting on impulse because that is how the ego is hardwired to respond throughout a person's life. By surrendering the ego, we surrender fear as well. Only after the ego is under control does the authentic self speak, hear, and feel. In conclusion, if you wish to appreciate the meaning of enlightenment, this wonderful sense of illumination, being mindful and conscious, it's important to understand the transcendental state of consciousness. In a transcendental state, you surrender your sense of the personal I and connect instead with the sense of we. Because we live together, we live in a common world. In this state, you achieve a conscious connection with the entire world. You are present with everyone, all races, ethnicities, ages, and ideas. There's no need to force your ideas on anyone, nor is there a tendency to personalize whatever is being shared with you. Behind every religion, every ideological belief, every cultural and political difference, there are simply human beings. When you surrender your need to define yourself through your ego, with all of its cultural conditioning, and let go of your need to be right, you discover yourself aligned with the correctness of the universe. The universe offers a far more extraordinary connection than anything you could discover when being unconsciously led by the ego. I'm Gary Noll. Thank you very much for listening.